Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello, my name's David Runciman, and this is Past, Present, Future. We have reached the last episode in our current series with the historian Gary Gerstle, in which we've been talking about the ideas behind American presidential elections. Today, the election we're discussing is 2008, when Barack Obama defeated first Hillary Clinton and then John McCain to become America's first black president. What did that victory symbolize? What did it mean in practice? And in what ways was it a harbinger of a very different future? Gary, we're getting closer and closer to the present. We have reached 2008, an extraordinary election in lots of ways. One of the things that made it, and I remember it all pretty well, I was avidly interested in it, such an exciting race, was that both of the primary contests were real roller coasters. They were very dramatic, and neither was in any way a foregone conclusion. So there was no sitting president running. George W. Bush had finished his two terms. Both main parties needed to pick a candidate, and it was a tough race. The Democratic Party race, in my memory, it started as a three-way race. Maybe the third candidate, John Edwards, was never plausibly going to win the nomination, but he looked pretty plausible for a while. Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, these were the main candidates. And you can divide them in lots of different ways. So there are policy differences between them. Edwards stood for a certain kind of politics. I think Edwards was more of a conventional Southern populist, Democratic politician, but also actually further to the left than the other two on some questions, for instance, healthcare. Obama and Clinton, harder to divide on some questions, but serious differences between them. Symbolically, very, very different candidates. John Edwards, Southern white man, conventional politician, lawyer. Obama, were he to win, would be the first non-white president and indeed candidate for the presidency. Likewise, Hillary Clinton. And then they campaigned very differently. So Obama famously saw the potential of the internet early on, tried to organize a grassroots campaign. Small money, little bits of money, but also networks of supporters feeding out from each other. Hillary Clinton, a more conventional Clinton campaign, a big money campaign using the party machinery. We know who won. Obama won. But when you look back at the contest, which is the big division here? Is it the symbolic division, non-white or a woman or a white man? Is it how they organized? Or was it policy? Was this a policy contest?
I think the policy contest was the least significant of the division among the candidates. They all occupied a similar space, center to left of center. Edwards being the furthest to the left, as you suggested, his healthcare plan was the most ambitious in terms of wanting to involve the government directly as opposed to arranging some mixed form of private and public provision. Obama, I think, positioned himself somewhat to the left of Hillary Clinton, but really not that far. And if you look carefully at their policies, it's hard to parse the differences between them. I think it was more that Hillary Clinton was the establishment and Barack Obama was this glamorous outsider.
He did use the Iraq War as a divider between them. He didn't vote for it. She did.
I was referring to domestic policy, there not being many differences. But Hillary Clinton had voted in support of the Iraq War in 2003. And Obama came out against the Iraq War. And by 2008, that issue had become very huge in American politics. And most people in America had felt by 2008 that this war of adventure had been a catastrophe for the United States and in the Middle East. And Barack Obama used the issue of Iraq repeatedly against Hillary Clinton and helped to paint her as a candidate of the old and that he was going to offer a new departure. And he put himself forward as the most compelling change candidate. And that was the central theme of his campaign. Yes, we can. America can change. New generation, fresh people in politics. This put him in position to best Hillary Clinton. And along with a very effective use of the iPhone appearing in 2006. So this is the, I call it the first iPhone election. We're tracking various media innovations and when they show up in politics. And as you said, he began to build a different kind of politics. It's often the outsiders trying to gain an advantage on more of an establishment star who become the most effective users of new media. And Obama, in this case, beginning from a point of deficit vis-a-vis Hillary Clinton, looking for whatever advantage he could find, having a younger, more innovative team around him, begins to use the networking capacities of the internet to push supporters, to raise money from lots of small donors, to network. Whereas Hillary Clinton this was going to be another Clinton-style campaign. And it should be said that for all her qualities, which were many, very talented candidate, very talented person, she did not have the public charisma that her husband Bill had and that Obama had in abundance. She also had to contend with a very significant part of the electorate not liking the Clintons for one reason or another, attitudes that had developed over a long period of time. And so as much as her being part of the Clinton project helped her, it also hurt her and damaged her among those who were eager to hear new voices. We shouldn't underestimate either the misogyny present in American politics, not just on the right, but in portions of the left, or the feeling that a woman is not as capable as a man. And the United States remains almost singular in terms of major nations in the world, haven't had a female president or prime minister. If Obama was going to be the first African-American president, Hillary Clinton, of course, was going to be the first female president of the United States.
It was very, very close. Obama was always a bit ahead, but I remember it was really drawn out. And just at the point where it looked like Obama would seal the deal, Clinton would win another primary. She won the big ones. One of the things that's really noticeable about the campaign, and it's a technical issue, but it relates to the different styles of campaigning and organization, which is that Obama won the caucuses, the caucus states, which suited his style of politics. And Hillary Clinton tended to win the big primaries, the more top-down events, even in the same state. So I was looking it up. In Texas, same state, Obama won the caucus vote in Texas. Hillary Clinton won the primary vote in Texas. And the campaign began with this extraordinary drama over just a few days. Obama won the Iowa caucuses, and everyone thought he was going to knock Hillary Clinton out. He seemed to be ahead. He was ahead in all of the polling. It moves to New Hampshire. And she won in New Hampshire, turning it on its head again. And that pattern repeated itself throughout the whole duration of it, right up to the convention. And she only conceded right at the last moment. So caucus politics, how does caucus politics suit Obama's style of campaigning relative to the primaries? The big primaries presumably are more amenable to big money, and caucus politics is more amenable to network effects?
Yes. The caucus politics is you assemble Democrats to come together to discuss the candidates and then cast their votes.
So if on the ground you've built up a little network of social influencers, that's the way to go. You're not going to throw money at advertising. You're going to get people to talk to people.
You are going to throw money at advertising, but the most effective way of organizing a caucus is to have your representatives out there networking. And for this purpose, the communication capacity of the internet turns out to be extraordinarily helpful. And the exact utility of email campaigning in 2008 hadn't really been figured out yet. And Obama's advisors are very clever at pioneering this network grassroots strategy, keeping in touch with a lot of people on the ground. These tend to be the more motivated voters. Those are the ones who come to caucuses, and they want to be involved in the process continuously, and they want to receive a lot of information, and they want to be networked with other people who are voting. They want to be in conversation. This requires a level of bottom-up communication that had been much harder to achieve prior to the internet iPhone age. And I think a lot of what Obama is doing is invisible to the broader public for a significant amount of time. This is often the case where someone takes advantage of a new media, they figure out how to use it in a way that other people have not. After the fact, their techniques and methods are studied, and then they spread to all the candidates in the next election. His use of these media gave Obama an advantage in these caucus contests that I think for a long time the Hillary Clinton campaign was not even fully aware of. It was a kind of stealth campaign, which has something to do with her surprise and shock at some of the outcomes, because the Clinton campaign had trouble tracking these developments in the old way.
And apparently she thought, you know, we win the big primaries, we win the nomination, win California, win Texas. She did win the big primaries and she lost the nomination. It's a weird failure, actually, of basic strategic insight.
Yes, but this occurring at a moment when the calculations one needs to make about how to get the nomination are in fact changing. So this is a technological transition in modes of campaigning that the Obama campaign is much quicker to grasp and embrace. Hillary Clinton also got in trouble in South Carolina. She won in New Hampshire, but Bill, as much as he was trying to stay out of this, could not stay out of the contest entirely. And he made some unfortunate remarks when Hillary was having trouble coming out of Iowa and even in New Hampshire about Barack Obama perhaps not being the best candidate for the Democratic Party, insinuating that it had something to do with his race. He didn't say this directly, but that was the insinuation. And the effect of that is that Hillary Clinton got clobbered in South Carolina, where the Democratic primary voters are heavily dominated by African Americans. It's something that would save Joe Biden's candidacy in 2020. He was lumbering along until he had South Carolina. The black vote saved him there. And the black vote in South Carolina, their interpretation of Bill Clinton's comments hurt her quite severely and created a problem for Hillary Clinton among minority voters. And Bill Clinton had thought of himself as a champion of minority voters, a champion of black voters, good relations with those communities. Toni Morrison even called him the first black president. So there was an assurance about a connection of the Clintons to the black community. And Bill Clinton said something that rendered that relationship problematic and turned the African-American vote quite decisively in Obama's favor and also ensured a very high turnout in those ranks. So that becomes a factor in this election as well. That's not about technology. That's about a tactical error that the Clintons made.
As you said, Hillary Clinton had a big mountain to climb to be the first female president, but Obama had a bigger mountain to climb. And I think before Obama's candidacy, most people would have thought that America was more likely to have a female president before it had a black president. But Obama did climb that mountain. But there was a point in the campaign where it looked like race and questions of race, leaving aside racism as such, was going to be his undoing. He had to respond to revelations of his connections to a preacher called Jeremiah Wright and circulating on the internet and then through the networks footage of some of the sermons that Jeremiah Wright had given that could be interpreted as an attack on white Americans. And of course, there's no route to the White House for Barack Obama without the support of many, many, many white Americans. And it was the pivotal moment in the campaign, in a way, on the Democratic side. He responded to it directly, and he came out of it, I think, strengthened. So Hillary didn't have an equivalent moment. How did he do it?
He gave a brilliant speech, which I think counts as one of the great speeches that I have heard in all of American politics. And I'm going to read an excerpt in a moment. But just to underscore the problem this caused for Obama, Jeremiah Wright was a fiery black nationalist preacher in Chicago. Barack and Michelle Obama had been members of his church for 20 years. It was a vital life connection for Obama into the African-American community. He grew up in a biracial home, often raised by whites more than blacks when his mother, because his father left, lived in Hawaii for a long time, which for an African-American is a very peripheral place to live, very multicultural, but out of the mainstream of the centers of American life. So for him, connecting himself to the African-American community was very important. And something that's been forgotten about his campaign is that there were quite a number of African-Americans skeptical of his campaign because he was not African-American enough. His mother was white. His father was from Kenya. Where's the connection? This is an issue in Obama's own life. And so this connection to this church, Jeremiah Wright, is an extraordinarily important part of his life and of his connection to Black life and the Black community in the United States. Wright married Michelle and Barack. I think he baptized his two daughters. So the familial personal connections were profound. And then circulating on the internet are these stories of Jeremiah Wright in full Black Panther mode, just condemning the United States, its murderous campaigns overseas, evil empire. These are circulating on the right in little places. And as soon as the central news organizations of the right get a hold of these, they realize this could be Obama's kryptonite, destroy whatever power he has. And so suddenly they're circulating everywhere. And Obama can't avoid the issue. And the question he has to address is, how can he, as you suggested, be the president of all America, given that he sat in Jeremiah's church for 20 years listening to these sermons? Obama chooses to give a speech in Philadelphia at the Constitution Center in March 2008, and literally it is a make-or-break moment for his campaign. Let me read a paragraph from that speech. "I am the son of a Black man from Kenya and a white woman from Kansas. I was raised with the help of a white grandfather who survived a depression to serve in Patton's army during World War II, and a white grandmother who worked on a bomber assembly line at Fort Leavenworth while he was overseas. I've gone to some of the best schools in America and lived in one of the world's poorest nations. I am married to a Black American who carries within her the blood of slaves and slave owners, an inheritance we pass on to our two precious daughters. I have brothers, sisters, nieces, nephews, uncles, and cousins of every race and every hue, scattered across three continents. And for as long as I live, I will never forget that in no other country on earth is my story even possible. It's a story that hasn't made me the most conventional of candidates, but it is a story that has seared into my genetic makeup the idea that this nation is more than the sum of its parts, that out of many, we are truly one." What's he doing here? He's tying his own experience to the framing of the American Constitution. Out of many, one. He calls for a more perfect union. He acknowledges the imperfections in American life. He acknowledges the imperfections in himself. But he also argues that he can become more perfect and America can become more perfect. And also the way in which he foregrounds his white family is his way of saying, I will not, if elected president, simply represent Jeremiah Wright's America. I will represent the America of my grandparents in Kansas. I will represent Kansas. I will represent white people everywhere. I is reference to his genetic makeup. He's saying, I am Black, but I am also white. And I perhaps am uniquely suited and able to help America to progress to a more perfect union. Later in the speech, he talks, not surprisingly, about the special challenges of African Americans in the United States, living with America's original sin and its aftermath, slavery. But he has this other extraordinary paragraph on the hardship of white Americans and makes a point of understanding the nature of their resentment and the nature of their anger. And the most important move he makes in this speech is to say, I, as a child of both whites and Blacks, can represent the hopes and comprehend the resentments of both groups. And thus, I can show the way to a more perfect union.
One of the ironies of that speech, and it connects back to the speech that first made his name as a national politician, the speech he gave at the Democratic Convention in 2004, when he spoke about using his own story to symbolize the fact that more unites red America and blue America, he put it as red and blue, not white and black then, than divides them. And he was quite explicitly channeling Thomas Jefferson. It was a Jeffersonian address, Jefferson's famous first inaugural, where he says, we are all Federalists, we are all Republicans, we have called by different names brethren of the same principle, out of many, one. It's a Jeffersonian idea. Jefferson, the slave owner, Jefferson, the man of the South, this is a kind of Jeffersonian politics. The difference being, as you say, Jefferson couldn't say it's my genetic makeup that allows me to do it. He can only say it as an abstract principle. His own life story tells a very, very different story. Obama, and for Obama's critics, it's a remarkable speech. It's extraordinarily egotistical. And some of Obama's critics have found in him a tendency to see in his life story a solution to America's problems. And you really have to believe in yourself to believe that you embody the more perfect union. And he did believe that in a way. I mean, I can see both sides of it. I can see why, for some people, this speech looks like an arrogant response to this problem. And at the same time, as a piece of political rhetoric, it is unmatchable.
Yes. To say that I, Obama, can embody all of America is a big claim. And I think it turned out a good part of America wouldn't let him get away with that claim. And even though he was enormously successful in gaining white voters, getting more white voters in 2008 than John Kerry got in 2004, there's going to be an extraordinary backlash against him and a rejection of his claim to embody all of America. There's a big part of America that adhere to the one drop rule. If you have one drop of being black, you are black. But it is also an extraordinary piece of rhetoric to try and bring the warring tribes of America together and to suggest that there is a way forward, there is a path forward, and it is the mission of the Constitution, which tells us to form a more perfect union, that commands us to follow this path. So the arrogance lies in saying, I am the messenger. The humility of the speech is that this is obligatory upon us because what the Constitution commands us to do. And, you know, as a black man, he is fully knowledgeable of the imperfection of this Constitution in terms of it legitimating slavery. But here he's at one with Lincoln, also a son of Illinois, saying that the possibility of a more perfect union out there exists and it can be within our grasp. Yes, we can.
His candidacy survives this, and indeed from this point on, it prospers. At the same time, this other incredible race, probably forgotten because it doesn't have the payoff of Obama's ultimate victory, is taking place on the Republican side. And actually, the Republican primary process has a bit more in common with what you just referenced there, which is Biden's candidacy in 2000. Because the ultimate winner, John McCain, like Biden, at a certain point in February, March, looked like he was finished. I mean, he was really struggling. And as with Biden, he turned it around. And in a matter of a few days and weeks, McCain went from being very, very unlikely to be the nominee to being almost certain to be the nominee. Before that, Rudy Giuliani was for a period thought to be the favorite. And Rudy Giuliani is another extraordinary American figure. I hesitate to say this. Academics should never do this. But I was in a taxi recently in London with a London cab driver, and he was wanting to talk about American politics and Trump and what was going on and why does America have to choose between Trump and Biden in a country of 300 million people? Isn't there anyone better? And then he said, the thing that's always puzzled me is, what happened to Rudy Giuliani? And by that, he didn't mean, how did this guy turn into the joke that he is today? He more meant, he was my favorite American politician. I remember that guy Giuliani after 9/11. He seemed to me like exactly the sort of person who should be president of the United States. Why did he never get a shot? And I tried to say, well, he tried and he failed and you don't want to see him now. But back then, that cab driver view was quite a widely held view. This guy had had a good post-9/11 period. And he seemed like he was a plausible Republican candidate. So before we get on to how McCain won it, what did happen to Rudy Giuliani?
It's very hard for a mayor from New York to get the presidential nomination of the United States of America. New York's a remarkable place, but in its diversity, in its cosmopolitanism, in its abrasiveness, it's not a representative place in America. Giuliani, I think, was extraordinary in reacting to 9/11. I say this not as a Giuliani fan. I never liked the man as a politician or as a figure. But the calm he brought to the disaster of 9/11, the effort he led to get the city through the devastating events, and in some respects, the nation, this became his national platform, was extraordinary. Something happened to him because he had always been an abrasive, hard-charging character, going after mobsters when he was mayor of New York in the 1990s, going hard after all criminals, an advocate of mass incarceration, cleaning the streets of anyone who was threatening public order. His police force was guilty of manhandling, some cases brutalizing alleged criminals, often minority, often innocent, violating their civil liberties. So he was very militant on law and order matters. Many New Yorkers gave him some credit for that, and they reelected him as mayor. What was most impressive about him on 9/11 was that a kind of calm came over him and a serenity that I have never seen in Giuliani before. And he was able to project confidence, calm, repose. But when he left New York to sell his program elsewhere, he was not an appealing figure to many Americans, and he was combative, he was abrasive, he was arrogant, he was proved to have too limited a knowledge of certain issues that were important to Americans outside of New York, and primary voters wouldn't vote for him. And this is also a time when the Republican Party had so securely reinvented itself as a party of the South and a party of the West that overcoming that as a born and bred New Yorker was a very tall order. And he also was a liberal on a lot of social issues, whether it was abortion. He had a rather checkered family life and married life, divorces, questions about his personal morals. And in what had become the Republican heartland, evangelical America in the South, Giuliani was not going to do well. And he underestimated the difficulty of the challenge, and he overestimated the degree to which 2001 had anointed him.
He was known as America's mayor.
America's mayor. He believed his own publicity, and thus, because he believed his own publicity, the rejection of him by Republican voters in 2008 was a devastating experience. And as we try and explain the fool Giuliani has become since his association with Trump, I can't fully explain it, but some of the most convincing explanations that I've heard have to do with the despair that overcame him after his rejection as a National Party candidate in 2008, his drinking issues, which had already been there, getting dramatically worse, his inability to, after he left the campaign, to leave the house, get out of bed, do anything. A deep depression came over him, and this points to unpreparedness for what the game of American politics on the national stage entails, and also speaks to a lack of resilience in him to do what anyone entering American politics has to be able to do, which is to parry defeat and recover from it.
The irony being he became the lackey of a man who overcame the barriers he couldn't overcome. Donald Trump is also a New Yorker, and Donald Trump has an even more checkered personal life. And yet Donald Trump got elected, not wholly, but in part with the votes of evangelicals in the South. McCain does then win the nomination. McCain represents a different strand of the Republican Party. McCain is a very well-established figure. He has run before. He ran in 2000 against George W. Bush. He's a senator. Increasingly hard for senators to get elected president of the United States. Obama did it, but he'd only been a senator for 20 minutes. McCain had a long record in the Senate, and you could always pick apart anyone's record because he was, among other things, someone who tried to create bipartisan consensus on certain issues, though he was quite far to the right on other issues. Was McCain a throwback by this point? Was 2008 too late for a candidate like John McCain? Because it was right at the end of his career. He was talked of as a future president for quite a long time, or at least a presidential candidate. It finally comes to him, like with Biden, very late.
I don't think he felt like a throwback. I think any Republican was going to have difficulty getting elected in 2008. Bush had been discredited in that election year by three events. The first was the Iraq War. The second is the financial crisis that overcomes America in the fall of 2008. And the third is Bush's handling of the devastation of New Orleans. So any candidate would have had difficulty getting elected. I don't think McCain's path to the presidency was impossible because he was a throwback. I think it was possible. I think his rise in the polls and his success in getting the nomination had quite a lot to do with the Republican field being rather weak. Romney stuck his toe in, but was uncertain, and America was uncertain about whether they would go for a Mormon in the White House. Huckabee, governor of Arkansas, colorful homespun figure, but didn't have the gravitas, I think, to carry something nationally. So part of McCain's rise was a kind of default, last man standing. 2008 was unusual for the vice presidential candidate not putting himself forward for the presidency. Cheney decided not to run, would have been a much stronger and more formidable candidate.
Do you think so? That's interesting. I never thought of that, because Cheney always struck me as a man who exercised power most effectively where no one was watching.
That came to be his MO. I think he would have had difficulty in 2008 because he was seen as the chief architect of the Iraq War and that fiasco. But he had an undeniable strength to him that would have gotten him serious attention in 2008. The Republican Party was feeling a kind of exhaustion in 2008, and there was a right wing forming in formation that was barely visible in the last 2 years of the Bush administration. Domestically, Bush tried to steer things after his early years toward the center, comprehensive immigration reform package. He had a program for assisting African Americans and Latinos in procuring homes for themselves. He was trying to steer toward the center, and this was alarming the right. In this way, McCain is also identified with what was becoming the Republican center. And if you're saying he's a throwback to an earlier era, if you're saying or suggesting that the future was going to belong to a more right-wing Republican Party, then it is correct to see McCain as occupying it's hard to call it a centrist space because the Republican Party was firmly on the right, but certainly a more moderate version than what was brewing on the right wing of the Republican Party.
Especially in his willingness to work with people from the other side of the aisle. I mean, that's the thing that is absolutely forbidden now on the Republican side.
Yes. And one of the projects he was involved in, along with Bush, was a big bipartisan measure to solve the immigration problem. There was a lot of hope for its passage, and it looked like it had a very good chance. This was one of Bush's priorities in his second term, and it was one of the best examples of Democrats and Republicans working together to reach some kind of compromise to solve one of America's most serious problems. And I remember I was called to testify before a House Judiciary Subcommittee on Immigration as part of the workup to this bill that they were doing. And I myself got blindsided by what I now recognize as a new Republican right. And the reason I got blindsided by the anger and venom and determination that there be no compromise with Democrats of any sort on a bill of this sort, one of the reasons I got blindsided was that this had not yet become fully visible in the manifest character of American politics, but it was there brewing. And Bush's decline over the last 2 years of his presidency, for the reasons I've outlined, Iraq, Katrina, and then his being on the post for when the great financial crash hits, gives this right wing an opportunity to strut itself and come into visibility and claim to be the next wave of Republican Party politics. And if we see it in those terms, then McCain is seen as part of the Republican Party that has to go, as part of the Bush wave that has to be pushed aside.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
The financial crisis actually hits during the campaign, quite near the end of the campaign. Lehman Brothers goes bust in September of 2008. And it's an extraordinarily dramatic moment. As George W. Bush said, of the entire world economy, this sucker could go down. And certain hours are crucial to preventing that from happening. All sorts of public officials, unelected public officials, turn out to be crucial to this process. But there is a campaign for president going on at the same time. It's precarious for both candidates because there's a lot going on, and also the question of what they're going to inherit. And there was a remarkable moment that I remember really vividly in the campaign. After Lehman Brothers went bust, at the real epicenter of the crisis, McCain suspended his campaign. He wanted to make this grand gesture. He's above politics in a way. There are things that are more important than this jostling. It's a very McCain gesture. He was, among other things, a war hero. Sometimes in a war, you've got to stand back or above it. It's time for us to suspend the campaign and come together in Washington, the two candidates, to see how we can help. And it was a catastrophic error. And the reason it was an error, and I can still picture the scene, this meeting is assembled in Washington and McCain comes to Washington. And Obama more or less says to him, so you called this meeting. What's your plan? He didn't have a plan. It was a disastrous error of judgment. John McCain was not the kind of politician to have, Obama was. McCain wasn't the kind of politician to have a worked up plan for rescuing the American economy from this great crisis. He just wanted to make the gesture that I'm the kind of politician who recognizes that there are things more important than politics. Well, if you haven't got a plan, you don't look like that politician. You look like a grandstander.
It was probably the decisive moment in the campaign. The sense of doom and catastrophe. Armageddon is not too strong a word. One of the insiders in that campaign refers to 18 days of Armageddon spanning September and October, in which the fear was the entire financial system of the world would simply shut down. This is what the failure of Lehman Brothers inspired. I believe it's the most dangerous 18 days in the world since the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, those 13 days. There, the threat was nuclear Armageddon. Here, the threat was financial Armageddon. If you read the memoirs of anyone who was involved in the day-to-day management of that crisis, every day they got up and every time they went to bed at night, they didn't know whether there was a financial system that would be standing the next day. It was that serious. So McCain's impulse to suspend campaigning was itself not misguided. In other words, he grasped the enormity and the severity of the situation, and his impulse, again, to cross the aisle. Let's talk to each other as you and I, David, are talking to each other now and see if we can save the country. But the idea that he would come without a plan, without a clue, and economics was not his forte. This is not where he established distinction legislatively. He was not known as a systematic thinker. He was known for his impulsiveness, his maverickness, and the impulsiveness shows up in his decision to suspend the campaign. That impulse is good, but as you said, no way in hell do you show up to a meeting like this without a plan, and your advisor shouldn't allow you to do that. So he exposed himself as someone unready to inherit the mantle of the presidency, and that a Republican showed himself unready at a time when the financial crash happened on the watch of a Republican president was a sign to the American people that they could not put another Republican in the White House, not in November 2008. And that certainly opened the door wider to Obama. One of the interesting counterfactuals, would Obama have been elected absent the financial crisis of 2008?
My feeling is that he probably would, because I also remember McCain's suspending of his campaign as being the act of a man who was behind and felt he needed to make a grand gesture to sort of reboot his campaign in a different direction. Throughout his contest with Obama, he was always coming from behind. There was a brief period where he seemed to have taken a gamble that had paid off, and the polling gap closed dramatically. And this is one of the other extraordinary features of 2008, which is it's this contest, deeply symbolic contest between Obama and McCain. And Obama's election looks like it's a historical turning point for all sorts of obvious reasons. It changes the face of America, American power in the world. But actually, it was the vice presidential candidates who pointed the way to the future. So Obama's vice presidential candidate was Joe Biden. McCain, just before the convention, chose Sarah Palin as his vice presidential candidate. And it was described at the time as a Hail Mary pass. You know, he was behind. He needed to do something dramatic, needed to make a gesture. A genuine, complete unknown. And the rumor is that McCain didn't know who she was either and was steered in her direction. And I think had one meeting with her and she wasn't properly vetted. And he thought impulsively, let's take a punt on this lady, as I'm sure he called her. And I can remember this really vividly. He unveiled her at the convention. And really, she was an unknown. And she gave an absolute barnstorming speech. It was funny. It was irreverent. She seemed different. She seemed not like a politician. And in many ways, she wasn't a conventional politician. She was from Alaska. She was younger. And it really did close the gap briefly until people got to know Sarah Palin a bit better and discovered she was completely unfit to be a heartbeat away from the presidency. And with McCain, an older man, not in great health, heartbeat mattered. But she was the harbinger of the future. She wasn't a Tea Party candidate as such, because that movement hadn't come into existence yet. But she pointed the way first to the Tea Party and then to Trump, the things that she stood for and the kind of politics that she embodied. And Biden, of course, no one knew it then. No one would have believed, I think, in 2008 that he would be running for president in 2024, because they would have got out their phones and said, now, when was he born? So how old would he be in 2024? Yeah, that's definitely, definitely not happening. But here we are. Sarah Palin was not John the Baptist to Donald Trump's Jesus Christ. But Sarah Palin was the person who pointed the way to the politics of 2024. Obama versus McCain is not the politics of 2024. Sarah Palin slash Donald Trump, Joe Biden is. It's one of those weird things that's only visible in hindsight. No one saw it in 2008, but that was the future.
Palin having a populist style of oratory that was tremendously effective, and it anticipates Donald Trump. I don't see Biden in the same way, because I don't think the Biden of 24 is the same figure as the Biden of 2008, whereas you can draw a straight line from Palin through Trump. I do think it was a disastrous choice for McCain in terms of the general population. And here I have done polling within my family, which includes on one side a significant Republican contingent, pretty hardcore Republican, all of whom voted for Obama in 2008. And the reason was Sarah Palin. And the worry was, McCain is an old man. Here, Biden becomes relevant again because the old man was 71 years old, not 81. Of course, he had illnesses arising from his years as a POW. But the vote for Obama was, on the part of the Republican members of my family, was a sense of the profound unfitness of Sarah Palin for the presidency.
Relative to which, Obama was a safe pair of hands. He had actually successfully, by that point, and in the midst of the financial crisis. I don't think anyone wants to think about Sarah Palin working her way through the financial crisis. Obama looked solid, right? Centrist and solid.
And by temperament, Palin's opposite. Conservative, cautious, don't do stupid things. But the temperament issue is crucial here too. And part of her appeal was you never knew what was going to come out of her mouth next. This is part of Trump's appeal and the delight that audiences at rallies have at the excitement of you just never know what's coming out of this person's mouth next. And it is a populist style of oratory oriented toward entertainment and excitement and fun. Fun, tremendous amount of fun. I often felt that during the COVID years, there would be these boat rallies where bunches of Trump supporters would gather in their boats and go out in fleets on rivers or bays or something just to have a grand old time. I mean, they were flying Trump flags. And I used to think at the time, those people are having more fun in COVID than I am. So there's a dynamic of fun and energy and excitement and politics, not as a vocation, but as a baseball match or a football match or something that you can get really excited about and lost in as part of a larger community. And Palin got that. Trump got that. But the choice of Palin, I think, also was a factor in costing McCain the election. And it's characteristic of McCain that this was being an impulsive man, being a maverick, doing the unconventional thing, The maverick thing was choosing Sarah Palin. The impulsive thing was choosing her without proper vetting, because he didn't really know. He invited her down to his Arizona ranch and was charmed by her and figure this will be fun, but didn't think it through in a systematic way. And it cost him a lot of Republican votes.
I want to get your evaluation of the presidency of Barack Obama, because there are lots of elections we could have chosen to discuss. And we've had people saying to us, why haven't you talked about 1876, 1948, whatever it is. 2008, it was a remarkable and dramatic campaign, but it was also, at the time, it seemed to be an absolute watershed moment in American politics. The symbolism of Obama's victory, he represented something new. He represented hope, or as Sarah Palin called it later, the hopey changey stuff. And he embodied it. And he wasn't shy about telling the world that he embodied it. There was a real feeling, often outside the United States, as well as inside the United States, when he came to Germany, he was treated like the Messiah, that this was a reinvention of America. It does not look like that in hindsight, but I still want to get your evaluation of his presidency. But there's also one question, one historical parallel here, and I think I touched on it before when we were talking about FDR. So 1932, Roosevelt inherits the presidency at a time of profound economic and financial crisis, longer lasting in that case, had been going on for years. There's a five-month interregnum in 1932 to 33 between winning the election and becoming president, inaugurated in March, and he refuses to do anything over those 5 months to help Hoover, anything bipartisan, anything constructive. He wants a completely fresh start. He wants to come in with clean hands. I don't know if Obama even had that choice, because the crisis was different, and in some ways the magnitude of it was different, and the need for immediate action was much more acute in an interconnected, globalized world. But Obama did make a different choice. He got involved. Once it was clear he was going to be president, he got involved, and he more or less inherited a lot of the people and the policies that, in desperation, the George Bush administration had put in place. He did tie his hands to a certain extent before he became president.
One has to be humble about this, because we don't know the reports that Obama was seeing every morning about the severity of the crash. A difference between 1932 and 2008 is that by 1932, the Depression had worked a lot of its calamity. The Depression had been going on for 3, going on 4 years. There was a sense of hitting a kind of bottom, but it was no longer a fast-moving set of events. Part of what characterizes the 2008-2009 financial crash, it is the most fast-moving global financial crash in all of human history. It is almost instantaneously global. And so the rapidity with which things are happening and unfolding, I think, puts Obama in a different set of circumstances than FDR. Or if we imagine putting FDR in the place of Obama, what would he have done? He might have been more inclined to cooperate, because the sense of the financial machinery of the world simply seizing up and ceasing to function was a daily reality that people were confronting. You didn't have the sense of velocity that Obama had to confront. So I understand his impulse to work with Bush. It was a compromise, because Bush was willing to move out of some of his doctrinaire small state provisions, let the markets figure it out themselves. He involved the government and the Federal Reserve in enormous ways in a desperate effort to save the economy. So he was, we might say, was moving left as Obama was moving right. About Obama being a transformational president, I first want to make sure our listeners understand, these are for the younger listeners, not the listeners of our age or older, what an extraordinarily hopeful moment this was for so many in American politics. America electing an African-American president 20 to 25 years before anyone thought it was going to happen. It has some equivalence to the collapse of the Soviet Union. No one could imagine that in 1989, and anyone who tells you otherwise now is not telling the truth. In the same way, in 2008, anyone who tells you, yeah, U.S. was ready for an African-American president, they're not telling you the truth. I still remember my sister's partner at the time was an African-American man who was dying of cancer. He was with days or a week to 10 days of death, and I spent the evening of the South Carolina primary with him. And he just burst into a wail of tears, just flooding down his cheeks. What was this about? So Obama won a tremendous victory in South Carolina, which put New Hampshire far behind and seem to resurrect his campaign. He knew he was dying, this man. And I think the tears were, thank God I was privileged to still be alive for this extraordinary moment. And the 2 million people who turned out for Obama in bitterly cold weather was so extraordinary that even the Daily Telegraph, not a known supporter of progressive of left causes, if you look at their reporting, waxes rhapsodic about what this entailed and a new beginning in America and among scholars and academics imagining a post-racial America. Turned out not to be that kind of transformational racial moment for America, because pretty soon after Obama entered the White House, a racial backlash got underway and a growing conviction in this land that had a slave system for almost 250 years that there should not be a black man in the White House. Trump has got to make use of this sentiment and feeling. The Tea Party has got to make use of this feeling and sentiment. It's got to be a crucial element of the populist right Republican Party rising to power.
It should be said that without Obama, maybe there's no Trump, because Trump's way in to American political life was the birther movement, and he was a leading light in it. He did not believe, for reasons of his own, but shared with many, many other people, that Barack Obama was actually an American citizen. It's not even dog whistle, it's just whistle.
It's just whistle. And when the Republicans do very well in the 2010 elections, McConnell becomes majority leader of the Senate, makes it his goal to deny Obama any legislative achievement for the remainder of his presidency. And even though Obama is reelected in 2012, there's hardly anything significant legislatively to come out of the Obama administration after 2010. And that also facilitates Trump, because part of Trump's politics is Washington is a swamp, and it's the Democratic Party that's part of the swamp. And it's Mitch McConnell, who, by the way, is a senator from Kentucky, so close to what had been the land of slavery. But Trump is also becomes a critic of McConnell for tolerating this swamp and the national legislature of America not getting anything done. And so this also, in a way, this backlash against Obama in a double sense. First, on the one hand, it's the birther rights, and on the other hand, it's McConnell and his supporters determined to ensure that Obama would be regarded as a failed president. This becomes part of their mission, quite apart from what the United States needs in terms of Congress to address its problems. Both these vectors underscore the severity of the reaction against Obama that sets in after the glorious moments of 2008. In the process of writing my most recent book, I rethought Obama's promise as a transformational president, not just in racial terms, but in political, economic terms as well. And the way in which he sought to help America recover from the global financial crash suggests that he is the last president of the neoliberal order, then the first president of what comes after the neoliberal order. He brought back Bill Clinton's economic team, not Rubin, but many of Rubin's top deputies. They are the ones organizing the recovery from the great financial crash. It's also the case that Obama's major legislative focus is on creating a system of universal health care, which had eluded many Democratic presidents, and he's going to be successful in that. But because he's so preoccupied with that, he doesn't want to create waves in terms of helping America recover from the global financial crash. And he decides that his first order of business is to save the banks and stop the financial system from cratering. He doesn't put a single banker in jail. He does not call bankers before Congress. It doesn't have authorized the Democratic Party to do that, to make them walk the gauntlet and take some responsibility for an economic crash that is arguably something of their own doing. And it turns out that Obama is going to do much more for the banks in the short term than he's going to do for ordinary Americans. And so if the banks largely recover by 2010, 11, 12, if you're an American with assets in the stock market, you are fully recovered from whatever losses you had in 2008, 2009. But if you are an American without assets in the stock market, the losses of the 2008-2009 financial crash are catastrophic. Millions of homes foreclosed on, millions of lost jobs, huge decline in the wealth of households. And the recovery of ordinary Americans is going to take far longer than the recovery of Wall Street. Main Street, in a sense, is left in the lurch. So that job levels, income levels don't really recover for almost a full decade after the financial crash of 2008-2009. And this is something that happens under Obama's watch. And people noticed. People noticed that the elites in America were benefiting in ways that ordinary Americans were not. And the sense of inequality of sacrifice contributes to rising populist anger and fervor, both on the right, which we've discussed, and on the left in terms of Occupy Wall Street and Bernie Sanders and Black Lives Matter, issues we haven't discussed, but become really powerful forces in American society. So I think as I see Obama now, I see him as preserving an older economic order, reinforcing the inequalities that it generated. And thus, surprisingly and unexpectedly, it falls to his successors to look for ways to lead America to a different economic future.
So when future historians look back, if Obama is the last president of the neoliberal era, will they say the first president of the post-neoliberal era is Joe Biden, or will they say it's Donald Trump?
Donald Trump.
We have reached the end of this series, but we have also recorded a couple of bonus episodes with Gary, one in which we talk about the amazing election of 1968, and another in which he and I discuss some of the big themes of this series and how they connect to the politics of 2024. And next time, we will tell you how you can subscribe so you can get those bonus episodes and also ad-free listening to Past, Present, Future. That will all be in our next episode, which is also the beginning of our new series. I'm going to be talking to the philosopher and writer Leah Ippi, author of the internationally best-selling memoir Free, Coming of Age at the End of History, about the history of ideas of human freedom. Leah and I are going to be talking about Plato, about Machiavelli, about Kant, about de Beauvoir. We are going to be discussing anarchism and existentialism and libertarianism. But we're also talking about faith and despair and the possibilities for humanity and what might come next. We've recorded a few of these already, and I have to say I have learnt an awful lot from these conversations, and I really hope that you will too. So that's starting next time, The History of Freedom with Leah Ippi, but also we'll be telling you how you can become a subscriber to Past, Present, Future, get bonus episodes in this series on American elections and the coming series on the history of freedom and much more, plus ad-free listening. You can subscribe to our newsletter now by just clicking on the link in the show description. And as always, do follow us on Twitter/X at PPF Ideas. There's a lot coming up on this podcast. I'm really excited about it, and I hope you'll join us for all of it. This has been Past, Present, Future, brought to you in partnership with the London Review of Books.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.